and we have to really escalate the noise we make so that we'll be heard.
Welcome to Gay USA. I'm Andy Hum.
I'm Ann Northrup.
And we come to you in deep mourning this week for the passing of Urvashi Vaid, one of the premier LGBTQ activists of all time.
Yeah, who died last week. And we're going to show our interview that we did with her last July. It becomes even more poignant and meaningful now in the wake of her death at a very much too young an age. And in other news, a federal judge has stopped Alabama from enforcing the criminalization of trans health care for minors.
And the Texas Supreme Court rendered a mixed decision on the investigations there of those providing trans health care for minors.
Two very important decisions. In Florida, students are standing up to say gay at graduation.
And students in Pennsylvania are standing up for a teacher in a middle school who was suspended for aiding a bullied trans student.
Brilliant move by an Oklahoma mother of a trans son. She has formed a new religion to challenge the laws against him.
I want to join, and Ann will review the new Hannah Gadsby show.
Yes, I will. But where shall we start with primary results, I guess, first.
Right. Okay. Well, in Pennsylvania, the Republican candidate who is the nominee, Doug Mastriano, who's considered not somebody who will easily be elected, during his acceptance speech on the night of his win, made fun of Rachel Levine, the former health commissioner who's transgender there, who is now in the Biden administration.
Oh, charming. Does he think that's going to get him elected governor? I don't think so.
It was awful.
Well, better news in Pennsylvania, where John Fetterman, in spite of his small stroke the other day, overwhelmingly won the Democratic nomination to run for governor against this monster, Mastriano.
And Democrat Josh Shapiro should be able to knock him off.
Fetterman's running for Senate.
Malcolm Kenyatta, the out gay candidate, got about 10% of the vote. And in the lieutenant governor's race, Austin Davis won, and Brian Sims, the out gay candidate, didn't do very well. But in Oregon, out lesbian Tina Kotek won big. The bisexual governor there, Kate Brown, is term limited. So she won the primary. She's going to be running against Christine Drazen, the former House Majority Leader. But there's also a third candidate, an unaffiliated former Democrat, Betsy Johnson. So it's a three-way race among women.
Well, we'll see. I'm hoping that Betsy Johnson does not run so that Tina has a better chance.
She's running right now. She's running her ads right now.
Well, okay. But hallelujah. Cawthorn is out in North Carolina.
Oh, I'm very sorry to see him concede and lose because he was the ugly face of the Republican Party.
Madison Cawthorn, I don't think there's any. I know you like to make the Republicans look ridiculous. I'm all for that, too. But anytime we can get rid of a monster, I'm for it.
So the Victory Fund says that 27 plus LGBTQ candidates won their primaries in Kentucky, North Carolina, Oregon, and Pennsylvania. And of course, in New York, our district lines are getting all screwed up. I don't want to get into all the details, but it may end up being that Mondaire Jones, the out-House member, will be running against out-Representative Sean Patrick Maloney. And he lashed out at Maloney for not even calling him to say he was going to come into what is mostly his district. And, of course, where we live, Jerry Nadler may run against Carolyn Maloney.
No relation. Yeah, it's a mess in New York, and they're still negotiating all this and when there will be primaries. And please just stay out of it.
And we should take a pause for 1 second to note the horror that went on in Buffalo and the unleashing of racial hatred. You've heard all about it on the news. The Supreme Court's about to put more guns in the hands of people in New York through a Supreme Court decision in June.
And all this business about replacement theory. Yes, the demographics of the United States are changing inevitably. It's not because anyone is making that happen. It's not because anyone is trying to change the demographics or get rid of white people.
Well, Karine Jean-Pierre having her first turn as the White House press secretary on Monday. She said, "I'm acutely aware that my presence at the podium represents a few firsts. I'm Black, gay, immigrant woman, the first of all those three to hold this position."
And what I appreciated was that she acknowledged her predecessors in these movements and says that she has learned from their excellence. Yeah. I thought that was a very terrific thing to say. But she's already under attack on the first day for not being specific enough about the Buffalo killer. There's just no way to win in her position. So we will just hope that she maintains her intelligence and dignity and powers through.
And President Biden marked Idahobit on May 17th, and we will link to his statement in our email.
And
you won't be seeing this when the GOP returns to power.
No. As the administration continues to try to get Brittany Griner out of Russia, Russia has announced that they are extending her pretrial detention by a month. But that is considered actually a good bit of news because it indicates that they are moving ahead on doing whatever they're doing, whether it's negotiating or completing the trial or whatever.
And the NBA commissioner is getting involved in that as well. Okay. Now, should we talk about these court cases?
Sure, yes.
All right, in Alabama, a federal court judge, Lyles Burke, a Trump appointee, enjoined the state from enforcing its felony gender-affirming care ban and says it's likely unconstitutional because it violates parents' fundamental right to direct medical care for their children, and it discriminates on the basis of gender nonconformity, from a Trump judge. The court allows the surgery ban to stay in place, but kids aren't seeking surgery.
No, there are no surgeries being done on young kids.
Right.
But he also allowed the maintenance of the rule that school officials are supposed to report trans kids to their parents.
That's true. So it's a somewhat mixed decision, but the court said denying health care would cause irreparable harm. The case was brought by NCLR, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, Southern Poverty Leadership Council, and HRC.
So now, puberty blockers and hormones, okay. Surgery, not okay. Reporting kids to parents.
Right,
now, in Texas, also a spectacular decision. This is in the case where the governor and the attorney general were telling the Department of Family Protective Services that they had to investigate parents of trans kids as child abusers. And the judge said that the department can continue investigations, but not at the direction of the governor and the attorney general. They must stay out of it.
This is the Supreme Court, 9 Republican judges.
Yes. And what they also said was that the family that brought the case in the first place, the department could not continue to investigate them because it would cause irreparable harm. So what we can deduce from this is that every family that may be subject to investigation can charge irreparable harm. And the court's decision to allow the department to consider investigating people doesn't mean that anyone will be investigated because the government can no longer order them to. The department has the right to make a decision, and on this decision, they may decide not to.
Well, okay. It was certainly a rebuke to the attorney general and the governor. All right. In Tennessee, a judge struck down a state law that businesses who let anybody come into the restroom, you know, based on their gender identity, had to post a sign about that. And it says it violates the First Amendment rights of the businesses. People also worry that that might protect the right for the businesses not to use proper pronouns.
And it, all, back in Texas, in Dallas, a doctor, Dr. Jimena Lopez, who treats trans youth, brought a case against Texas's rule against medical care for trans youth. And the judge in Dallas overruled the state and said the medical care for trans youth can continue.
Let's go to Florida. A couple of things. Governor DeSantis just banned protesting outside people's homes. That's unconstitutional. And he also wants to have the state take over the Disney district and run it itself and appoint everybody to run it. But the big story is how a gay activist and high school class president, Xander Morich, led protests versus the Don't Say Gay law and is now the graduation speaker. And the principal said, you better not talk about your activism or your role in this lawsuit. We're going to cut off your mic. I suggest that he bring a megaphone under his robe. There's a petition to let Xander speak. He secured 10,000 Say Gay stickers to distribute among seniors all across Florida to wear on their graduation robes. So, you know, he's really standing up there. What a great activist. And
he's the senior class president at Pine View School, and he is going to Harvard. So I don't think he's too worried about what this principal might do to him. All right.
And by the way, Disney parks are doing fine, despite all the backlash.
Well, now DeSantis is offering to have the state pay all the debt that was going to be loaded on the local citizens.
To take over the running of the district.
Yes, exactly. All right. In Pennsylvania, at the Lenape Middle School, students are protesting bullying and harassment and the refusal to use preferred names and pronouns. So they staged a little protest there. One of them wearing a Susie and the Banshees T-shirt. And the school administration is denying that they suspended a teacher who'd been supportive of the kids. It's sort of a mess there. But the students, again, are standing up.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Let's the Louisiana.
One more of students standing up. Wyoming. This is actually my favorite story.
All right.
Senator Cynthia Loomis of Wyoming was the graduation speaker at the University of Wyoming. So she got up and started, you know, a lot of nonsense, right-wing nonsense, including, I believe in the two sexes, men and women, blah, blah, blah. And the students all started.
Boo! Boo! That's what she got.
We would tell you to get out of there.
The University of Wyoming issued a statement contradicting her lack of understanding of science and criticizing her bad manners.
And here we thought Wyoming was a conservative place. Yay, Wyoming students.
All right. In Oklahoma, a mother of a trans son, Tiffany Holloway, has founded a pro-trans church to oppose Republican efforts to criminalize gender-affirming medical care. Her 16-year-old son threatened suicide if he couldn't get care. The Church of Prismatic Light is applying for a tax-exempt status. One of its central tenets is the right to medically transition, bodily autonomy, consensual love. It has 143,000 followers on TikTok, and it wants to file lawsuits against anti-LGBT legislation as a violation of their religious freedom. We should all incorporate as a church and take over South Dakota while we're at it so we can have two senators.
That would be delightful. I love that creativity. And people did used to individually get themselves designated a church. to do things like that. And in all roads lead back to Pennsylvania. In Kutztown, Pennsylvania, a bunch of sixth to 10th graders have started meeting at a local bookstore as the Teen Banned Book Club. They are getting together to read banned books. And one of the kids said they were really eye-opening. They are books that make you think.
And Dallas, a county judge, ruled that treatment for trans youth can resume at the Genesis Clinic there run that they had shut down. So,
yeah,
and in New York, an upstate judge ruled that the court could not order a new birth certificate for a trans person born in Vermont. It's easy in New York. It's harder in Vermont. And the judge is saying it just doesn't jive. You got to go back to Vermont.
Yeah, although Vermont is in the process of changing its rules. So that may work itself out quickly. Okay, let's deal first with in Utah, in Moab, Utah. We've told you before about the lesbian couple that was murdered, and there was some mystery about who did it at a campground. They now think that was on last August 18th. They now think they've identified the murderer. It's this guy on the left, Adam Pinkowitz, who was a co-worker of one of them at the local McDonald's. He has since committed suicide and confessed to this before he committed suicide.
Horrible, horrible crime.
Horrible crime.
And another trans murder, right?
Yes, in Florida, in Opa-locka, Florida, they have found the body of a trans woman, Nedra Sequence Moss, 50 years old. She had been shot dead, and then her body was dumped in Opa-locka somewhere. 100 people showed up at a vigil for her. She worked for a local school district, beloved, a terrible loss in Florida.
All driven by the same hate spouted on places like Fox News.
Coming up this weekend in Brooklyn at Brighton Beach Pride, the sixth edition run by RUSA LGBT, immigrants from Russia who are doing a big pro-Ukraine event of Brighton Beach Pride this year.
We also lost this week Dr. Anthony Scarsella. He has died at 77. He was the last surviving member of a historic group that 40 years ago pioneered health care for gay men and people with HIV, the Pacific Oaks Medical Group. Started an AIDS unit at major hospitals, survived by his partner of 44 years, Terry Miller.
International news?
Yep.
Okay. Tokyo, Japan, the entire city is going to register same-sex partners, not marriage yet, but a step along the way.
Peter Tatchell, our old friend, was invited to the Queen's Jubilee. He's an activist, and he says, you know, you can call me a national treasure, but you don't even say the words LGBTQ. You've never stood up for or sponsored an LGBTQ charity. And, you know, so and she never brings it up with the Commonwealth, which he values so much. He wants an elected president for.
So he rejected the invitation to the Jubilee.
Yeah.
In Russia, we told you that the Pussy Riot leader and her girlfriend had gotten out of Russia. Now they are on the most wanted list by the Russians.
That's right.
And in Indonesia, a podcast host interviewed a gay male married couple, and all the religious right wingers in Indonesia freaked out. The interview was then deleted from the podcast and replaced by an apologetic interview with a cleric.
In the UK, a young soccer player came out, Jake Daniels, 17, the first to come out. He plays for Blackpool, the first to come out in 32 years. It's hard there in soccer, football, they call it. He said he knew since he was six, says it has already improved his play, and he got a great reaction from teammates. Boris Johnson thanked him for his bravery, but Boris doesn't have the bravery to stand up for trans people.
Qatar is holding the World Cup soccer championship, And they have promised to be welcoming to LGBTQ people. So someone put together a little test of World Cup designated hotels by calling and trying to make reservations for same-sex couples. 33 hotels said yes. 20 hotels said yes if you remain closeted. And three said no. Oh, it was Scandinavian reporters who tested that out. The tournament
good for them.
November and December. Greece has banned conversion therapy for minors and requires explicit consent from any adults who want to do it. And, back to soccer. The in France, the Paris Saint-Germain soccer team was wearing rainbow colored uniforms for Idaho Bit, the International Day Against Homophobia, etc. And one team member refused to wear them, so he was not allowed to play. And the same thing happened with him last year. He's from Senegal, and they have a death penalty for gay people. And in Bulgaria, a court has ruled that the government must give a birth certificate to the daughter of a lesbian couple. One member of the couple is Bulgarian, the other is from Gibraltar. The child was born in Spain. Bulgaria must give her a birth certificate.
Okay.
AIDS news. In the state of Georgia, in the U.S. here, the penalties are now slightly diminished for unprotected sex without disclosure of HIV status. But transmission is not required. But now you can get 5 years in prison instead of 10.
Good grief.
And in entertainment news,
yep.
I did go see Hannah Gadsby's new third big show. There she is on the left, and there's her wife.
Hannah Gadsby, who was an answer on Jeopardy this week, under well, palindromes.
The show is more light and charming than the previous ones. You can tell her mood at any given moment by watching these shows. She talks about COVID. She talks about her family, dogs, rabbits, her broken leg, her autism, and telling the truth. She's on a whole U.S. and world tour. She has a book out. You can go to her website to get details on all of that. I enjoyed the show very much. It's no longer, it's finished its run at BAM, but you can catch her all over the country and the world.
I stumbled on Netflix on Anatomy of a Scandal, which is about a philandering MP and worse, Rupert Friend. Sienna Miller's in it and Michelle Dockery. It's a very absorbing trial mystery story. Very well done. Anatomy of a Scandal, Netflix.
And Marvel Comics has a new Pride series. Issue one comes out in June with a new trans mutant superhero, Sheila Sexton, also known as Escapade. There she is. And Queer as Folk, the new version, Richard, comes to Peacock on June 7th with Kim Cattrall and Juliet Lewis as mothers of some of the gay men. New Fest, the LGBTQ film festival, comes here to New York online and in person June 2nd to 6th. And Gerard Carmichael says, after coming out in his Rothaniel HBO special, I feel freer. Now I can smile.
All right. Well, now we're going to move on to the rest of our show devoted to Urvashi Vaid, who died at the age of 63 of cancer this on May 14th, survived by her longtime partner, Kate Clinton. She was
wife.
Right. She was a lawyer and an LGBTQ activist for really more than four decades. When she was an activist and she was like 6 years old. Which comes up in the interview with her.
So we did this interview with her last July, but and she goes over all of this and her current projects of the Women's Survey, which is still current and available, and the museum that's being built. But the point about Urvashi is that she really was a fundamentally important legendary activist who had her hand in everything and who was active both in the activist community with, for instance, ACT UP and other movement groups, and also at home in the donor community with prominent wealthy people who she would then get to finance all of this. She worked at the Ford Foundation. She ran the Arcus Foundation. She started with the ACLU Prison Project, working on prison issues and bringing HIV into that work.
She honed her organizing skills at Vassar, she said.
Well, she and I were fellow Vassar graduates and bonded over that, although she was younger. 63, a tragic, tragic loss at that age. She battled cancer for some years and finally succumbed. And it's just shocking that she's gone.
She said that her view of liberation came from movements to end colonial occupation and white supremacy. You know, she was born in New Delhi in 1958, right. But the family moved to the United States in 66.
So let's, we're now going to show you the entire interview we did last July, and then we'll come back after that for some closing thoughts.
Let's bring on our guest, the, as you say, legendary activist, Urvashi Bhad. Urvashi has done it all.
Well, we're of that generation that all of us can say that, right?
Oh, well, I think you top the list. From the ACLU Prison Project to Gay Community News in Boston to the running the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, the Arcus Foundation, what else?
Well, we have a picture I want to put up of you protesting the elder President Bush in 1990 over AIDS. This was a very bold move, but it wasn't your first. Your first demonstration was an anti-war protest at the age of 11.
Well, I happened to grow up in a tiny town in upstate New York called Potsdam, where my dad was a college professor. So there were the anti-war protests, you know, walking right by our house, and because the students were even up there were protesting. So I think, you know, I think that was probably my first protest, just kind of curiosity, but also affinity. I think early on, I felt an affinity for social change activism. Just, and, you know, there were about three channels when we were growing up, right? So the coverage, you know, we all, my family, we watched the 6:30 news or six, together, the national news, Walter Cronkite or NBC. And they were covering the civil rights movement. They were covering the anti-war movement a little bit. And it was just, I just thought, A, it was right. B, I wanted to join. Like, and it just touched me.
I had the same experience. I'm older than you, but I was watching the same things. And it just reached out of that screen and grabbed me.
And you were giving speeches for George McGovern at the age of 12. That was my first vote and my only happy vote for president.
Yeah, I had the chance to speak at a, you know, because I was, I don't know, I had good grades, so I got to speak at some assembly and in junior high. And in 72, what are you going to do except talk about McGovern?
Well, did you come from a progressive family and household that supported you in this?
I came from my parents were both artists in a way. I mean, actually, they were. My dad was a writer, and that's what he wanted to be ever since he was a young man. And he became a really important Hindi language writer. And he wrote novels, some plays, short stories, amazing experimental novels in Hindi. And my mom started being a poet in her 60s. And became a painter. She was amazing in her 70s. And until she passed, she painted these incredible abstract canvases. So when I grew up, our house was full of ideas, books, people with ideas, mostly artists. A lot of their friends in India and here were artists, dancers, poets, writers, visual artists. And so that, they weren't, my parents, though, were not political activists. They never saw that as their calling. And they actually, my dad and I had many arguments about, is art more important than politics? And I always say that they finally got what I was doing when they read my book, Virtual Equality. They were like, oh, that's what she's been talking about activism. It kind of had to be translated into a medium that they respected.
That was back in 1995, Virtual Equality, the mainstreaming of gay and lesbian liberation. And you subsequently wrote Irresistible Revolution, confronting race, class, and the assumptions of LGBT politics in 2012.
Yeah. When I left the task force, I decided I wanted to write a book, and I had no idea. And I credit the late Jed Mattis. Do you remember Jed? He was an in New York, very involved in our community, helped Hetrick Martin establish itself, among others. And he happened to be a literary agent. He was the only literary agent I had ever met in my life and at that time. And I wrote to him and said, Jed, I'm thinking about writing a book. Will you just, you know, tell me what I should do? And he said, not only will I tell you what you should do, but I'll represent you. And he encouraged me to write him a letter describing the book I wanted to write. He said, don't worry about a proposal. Just tell me what you want to write. And that's how it began. So I outlined this idea about writing from my experience, a sort of a political analysis of the queer movement at the time. And that's what virtual equality was. It was a critique of that argued that we really needed to be centered on social justice and a broader view of rights and liberation rather than a narrow view. And then I just told a lot of different, I talked about a lot of different aspects of my own life and work.
So I thought we'd get to the bigger overview a little later in this, but we're here now. So before we get to talking about the survey and the museum and everything, how's this working out? How's the movement doing? What's your bird's eye view of all this?
I mean, we have to be proud of what so many thousands and thousands of activists have accomplished. I credit all of us, literally hundreds of thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, queer people, especially LGBTQ people in towns all over this country who stood up and fought back and said, you know, this is wrong, and challenged every institution, starting with our own families, right? Faith-based institutions, you know, governments, nonprofits, service providers, every single space. And that's what has enabled our movement to be so vibrant to this day. It still exists. It's alive. And I really value that. I think that, you know, at the national level, the movement has also changed. Its leadership is more reflective. There are a lot of people of color who are running major institutions. In fact, the task force, HRC, National Center for Lesbian Rights, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, you know, it's phenomenal, are run by incredibly talented leaders who've been in our movement and stepped up to take the helm. And that gives me a lot of encouragement. I think our obstacles are deeper and greater than ever. I think there's a lot of complacency in our movement, which worries me. And I think that there's a lot of ignoring of the fact that not all parts of our community are doing well. So I'll start with that. I mean, the obstacles are the right wing. They're strong. They're deep. They're well-funded. They're relentless. Kate and I debate, is the right wing, like, are they vampires or are they zombies or are they aliens? And it's a serious discussion that's kind of a thread.
We have a picture of you.
All of the above.
It could be different manifestations at different times, but like Game of Thrones, they're the White Walkers, literally, right? If you've ever seen that, I don't know, Anne, you know, you probably...
I'm too busy watching.
And you didn't see Game of Thrones, but some of us...
You're watching Game of Thrones. I'm watching The Real Housewives.
But you referenced Kate Clinton, your partner since 1998?
Actually, 1988.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, we met at the War Conference.
Oh my God, the War Conference. Yes, we were both there. Well, you're now running your own organization, the VAD Group. So you're doing strategic counseling. What do you tell people about fighting back against the right wing and Mitch McConnell and everybody else who's out to kill us?
Well, it's a two-pronged strategy. You've got to have political power. So we have to defeat them politically, starting at the local state level and then working up to the national. Too many people go right to the national. We have got to really win at the local level, city councils, mayors, state legislatures, governors, judicials, appointments, DAs, everything. And then the other thing that we have to do is to continue the fight culturally. So you got to defeat the right politically and culturally. And the cultural struggle is about what we learned from our own experience being a despised minority. You know, how do you turn outlaws into in-laws? That's what we did. What a win, right?
Yeah, cute.
Despised outlaws. Now where everybody's like, oy, they're the in-laws. They're coming over again. And and I think we have to sort of combat the right wing culturally by engaging with people. All 75 million people who voted for Trump, or however many of them are, can't be written off. You have to take the fight to them in terms of our stories of our lives, argue with them, push back and say, well, you know, we can find common ground here. We can't find common ground here. I mean, I really believe that's the only way to win.
Well, they do, Paul.
There's so many lies and disinformation. Sorry, Andy.
No, I mean, they do polling, and now it says the majority of Republicans support same-sex marriage, but they also support candidates who vote against all of our rights.
I know. It's kooky. So I think there's some kind of disconnect. I don't know if we'll be able to overcome the kind of, I mean, if it's true aliens, you can't really overcome that.
Well, isn't it about their priorities, though? They may be with us on some of these issues, but their priorities, we're not their priority when they then go into the voting booth. And what the heck are we going to do about Kyrsten Sinema?
I guess she must have ambitions for higher office. And she's, I don't know, because... You know, she started out quite a bit more progressive than she's manifesting right now. So I think it's about making a strategic calculation about how she has to get reelected in that state, which is tough. It's a tough state. You know, I think I'm trying to be generous and believe that her heart is in the right place. I think she's certainly earned the right to be trusted a little bit, I think, or a lot. I mean, no politician in my experience has ever voted entirely the way I would like them to vote. There's few who have. Political, you know, Barney always used to say, Barney Frank was like, you know, it's all about compromise and you have to be willing to compromise, which is probably why none of us ever went into mainstream politics. Like, we're kind of uncompromising people. And you can be that way as an advocate because you can push, push, push. And that's really necessary. But some people have to go in there and negotiate and argue. So I guess that's what she's doing.
Well, Barney also said, I think, that the only politician who he ever voted for who was pure was himself in his first race only.
Well, you know, I do wonder sometimes what it would have been like if Milk hadn't been murdered. He was pretty amazing. I mean, you know, and people like that ilk. Or I wonder sometimes if what it would have been like if we had Ginny Appuzzo running. You know, she was one of my heroes coming up as a young activist, and I still look up to her. And she's just so smart and always had this honesty in whatever she said. And that's what I relate to in a political leader is honesty. Tell me the truth. If you can't vote a certain way, tell me why. And, you know, tell me the truth.
So one of the ways we're trying to get honest is with this survey that you have now created, because we need data. We need facts. So tell us about this LGBTQ plus women's survey.
You know, we need more information about all parts of our community because we have been so invisibilized. We are not routinely included in mainstream surveys or data collection. But more deeply than that, I was thinking about with a lot of people, I was thinking about how many LGBTQ women there are and how little we know about us. And what are our families like? How many of us have kids? I mean, what kinds of experiences are we having today of discrimination? You know, we've had some data and some breakthroughs in the federal collection of information that allows us to gather insights. Bianca Wilson at the Williams Institute has assembled a great compilation of health and socioeconomic information about LGBTQ women from a couple of national surveys that have been done recently, like post 2017. But we really wanted to go deeper. And that's what the LGBTQ plus women survey is about. And I encourage, and we also wanted to create a really inclusive platform, because the thing about lesbians is that many of us, you know, like there's all different kinds of lesbian experience. I mean, like, I think it's more varied than gay men, to be honest. Like, you've got lesbians who are lesbians until graduation. You've got lesbians who were married to a guy for 40 years and then fell in love with their next door neighbor and came out. You've got lesbians who were lesbians with a woman for 40 years and then decided to go, like, they fell in love with a man or decided to be with men. You've got trans people and trans men. You've got, you know, trans lesbians, and you've got non-binary queers. You've got aromantic lesbians. I mean, it's like every varying. And I think we are such a range. We wanted to allow our community to express that. And the survey is incredibly inclusive in that it encourages all sorts of people who might identify or have identified or have had lesbian experience to share. And what comes out. So our goal is to really try to take this information, get it back out to community-based organizations, service providers, advocacy groups, and say, what does it mean that what should we be doing in terms of our advocacy agenda, in terms of the services we're developing for our community, how we talk about our community? We hope that it gives a clearer picture. I was really impressed by the National Transgender Discrimination Study that was done by NCTE and the task force. They did a couple of rounds of them, and they're, I think, about to do a third round. The first round was in 2011, and the next was in 2015. And those community surveys were the first time we had like a kind of a 360 picture of trans people from trans people's own voices. And I've read those and used those, and they gave me so much insight and used those for organizing in so many different contexts. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could have that kind of archive about queer women?
So benefit of our podcast listeners, the link is LGBTQ Women's Survey.
Women's Survey.org.
It's open just to people in the USA, but it is, as you say, open to people who have identified as women at any point in their journeys.
Yes. It's really, we're trying to be as inclusive as we can. And you know, the reason we didn't do global is we just don't have the bandwidth. And there are great people around the world who are doing comparable work.
And we'll put a link to the survey in our weekly show notes. So go to gayusatv.org if you're not already signed up with us, and you can access the survey through a link there. And this is not your only project. You're also on the board of this new LGBTQ plus museum.
Yeah, the American Museum of LGBTQ History and Culture is an effort to create a national museum in New York. And I've been on the board about 3 years. I think the project started about, I think, 2017 with a group of people meeting and trying to figure this out. It's really exciting. We have a number of great projects, history projects, archive projects around the country, the one archive in LA. There's a Stonewall Museum in Florida. So there's a lot of great institutions. We felt there was space and need for a national institution that will be based in New York that is really documenting the stories and plurality of queer experience, and especially the stories of our movement. Collecting information, doing exhibitions, focusing on developing educational materials and curricula that can teach about our movement's histories.
So that's the LGBTQ, the word plus, museum.org. This is part of an expansion of the New York Historical Society.
Well, we made a partnership with the New York Historical Society, which is run by the brilliant Louise Mirror, And the Historical Society had done exhibits and exhibitions about LGBTQ history over the years. And I think we partnered with them. And then they approached us about the fact that they're going to build an addition to the Historical Society building in New York. And they wondered if we wanted to partner with them on that. And we did. And we've together went to the city council and secured some funding from the mayor and the city council. And of course, the bulk of it will be raised privately for this edition. And the idea is that the museum, the LGBTQ museum, will have a floor within this new edition when it's built. And we'll be able to use that to program our exhibits, have a physical space with its own, access and entry, but will be incubated in a way by the Historical Society, one of the oldest museum in New York, and learn from them about what it takes to run a museum well, and every little detail we're going to have to learn. And I think it's so exciting for us as a startup to be able to be sponsored in this way by an experienced institution. And ultimately, our goal is to have a freestanding building that is at least 75,000 square feet that allows us the range of exhibits and multimedia, interactive, accessible programs that we can do. In between now and that vision, we're going to use virtual programming, and when we are able to do in-person events, to curate all sorts of conversations and hopefully eventually exhibits about our communities.
And that's on Central Park.
Movement history.
That's on Central Park West between 77th and 76th Street. I believe this is going to be on the 76th Street side. When do you expect this to possibly open?
I think the building, the thing is that they have plans and are ready to move forward with it's going to take a couple of years. So I suspect 4 years before the building opens.
Okay.
But it's not like nothing will happen in between now and then. The existing building exists and we can program within that and do events.
And how can people connect to this project?
Go on the website and you can sign up. We can send you more information. You can learn more about it. The American LGBTQ Museum.
It's really a perfect idea. And when you hear about it, you think, why didn't this happen a long time ago? But the timing is probably perfect. And the system of getting it in place and, as you say, being mentored by the Historical Society is just delicious. It's so good. So you're doing this, you're doing the survey, you're running your counseling organization and doing, I'm sure, 9 million other things. And at the same time, facing the challenge of breast cancer, which you've been quite open about to confront. So how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. But it's an experience that so many millions of us have, cancer and breast cancer. So many lesbians and queer women have it, and people have it, queer people. And I think, one of the reasons I'm out about it is that I think it's important for people to know that that we walk among you, that we're doing incredible things, that a cancer diagnosis is very serious and it affects me at different points where I'm like really weak and whatever. But in general, I'm doing a lot and probably doing so with a sense of urgency that I didn't have before, because what I have is metastatic cancer. And that's pretty grim in terms of its ultimate prognosis. But I was joking with you earlier that there's a couple of things that I would note. One is that it's for somebody who railed against Big Pharma most of my life. Now I find myself cheering them on. I'm here because of
situational ethics.
I'm here because of drugs. And the second piece of that is because of health insurance. And this is why we need universal health insurance, so every single person has excellent access you know, and I'm lucky enough to have health insurance through my little consulting business. And that enables me to access healthcare. And the drug companies enable me to access clinical trials that allow me to be able to benefit from advances in medicine, like targeted therapies. You know, the old chemo was just, which I had when I first got breast cancer 9 years ago, was just, it just killed the good cells and the bad. It was like drinking bleach to bring back an old. But the newer chemos are more targeted, and they attach to the cancer cells through mechanisms kind of like the new coronavirus vaccines. Yeah. They're delivered to the, attached to certain proteins on the cancer cell, and they deliver the chemo into the cell so they don't cause systemic damage, which is kind of remarkable. It's just in my life, I've seen that progress, as I have with HIV. You know, we spent, each of us has lived through a number of these life-threatening situations in our community and in our families and in our closest friends' lives, or not lived through them, as so many people we lost. And it reminds me of all the things we were fighting for during the height of the AIDS epidemic, you know, better access to treatments and healthcare and health insurance, you know, for everybody, you know, cheaper drugs. So they're more affordable to more people, and more investment in research and, you know, like making that a priority for this country. It's kind of astonishing that cancer is so prevalent and people talk about as if it can't be, oh, it's just, you know, it is what it is. But actually it isn't. It can be tackled in creative ways. And it just, a lot of cancers just require basic research.
But these are the fights that have gone on from time immemorial and are continuing of, are we going to care about taking care of people? And are we going to do what needs to be done to give everyone a shot at a healthy and productive life?
It brings us back full circle to where we started, which is political power.
Yeah.
You know, we cannot win these fights without the power to win them. And that means better candidates running who aren't afraid to stand up and push the envelope. That means more of us voting. You know, LPAC, which is the lesbian super PAC that I helped start in 2012, just last couple of years has done some surveying of using like Celinda Lake's firm to do national sort of surveys of lesbians and straight women and men. And doing some comparative, you can find the data at projectlpac.org, which is the 501c3 arm of the super PAC. And there's two studies. And what they show is that even though a majority of lesbians are registered voters, there's a significant number who aren't registered. Like, I think if memory serves me correct, it was like 19%. And then there's another significant number, like 14% or something, that are like very alienated from politics and don't see much difference between the parties and don't therefore aren't motivated to vote even when they have a great deal of political awareness.
Yeah. I do want to congratulate LPAC because four of your endorsed candidates, and they're real progressives, I mean, have won council seats in New York, Lynn Shulman and Tiffany Caban in Queens, Kristen Richardson Jordan in Harlem, and Crystal Hudson in Brooklyn. So,
and both Kristen and Crystal will be, I think, the first Black lesbians, Black queer people in the city council, women in the city council.
That's great.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Real strong progressives.
Yeah.
Well, LPAC is terrific, and it's run by the brilliant Lisa Turner, who's just one of the best political minds around and a really smart woman, and has a great group of board members that have really shepherded this organization and a bunch of supporters. And everybody can support LPAC. You don't have to be a wealthy person. You know, $10, whatever you can give, helps the organization invest in candidates that are lesbians and that are pro-lesbian and pro-racial justice and pro-women's rights.
And the majority of the city council in New York will be women for the first time.
Well, this will be an interesting experiment in New York City, the city that doesn't work.
You think, well, you know, when it becomes a total mess, that's when the women come in, right?
Yeah. We'll see. We shall see.
You think we're going to get a woman mayor? What's
no.
your belief?
Oh, eventually, but not right now.
Not this time?
No. So go back to work. You have too many projects. We have more news to give our audience, but thanks, sir.
Thank you both so much for having
love,
me.
Love to Kate, and we'll see you soon.
See you soon. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Interview was so sad, but so insightful.
It's just really hard for me to sort of grapple with the idea that she's gone. She's such a vibrant presence and such a seminal figure in our movement and many movements. She was very involved with South Asian political organizing in this country. And
you know, she got an award not too long ago. She said, we're facing an existential threat now to our existence, and we have to be much more aggressive and militant if we're going to survive.
A couple of things. First of all, really, such deep, deep love to Kate Clinton, who they were together for decades, and through this long fight that Irv had with cancer. Also, a note about the book, Virtual Equality. It was the first book commissioned by a major publisher or bought by a major publisher that was an LGBTQ book. It was very important at the time and a stunning, large advance and really a step forward.
And look, she co-founded Creating Change 34 years ago.
She did.
Now, there is supposed to be a memorial service on her birthday, which is October the 8th, and we will, of course, provide you details about that.
Yes. And I also, you know, I'm always struck by the very leftist progressive LGBTQ people who complain about marriage as a goal of the movement, and then they all end up getting married. So I find that amusing, but because I always thought marriage was, of course, not the be all and end all. I'm not married, have no plans to be so, but I always saw it as a vehicle for legitimacy or equality in the country. And I certainly think Irv and Kate and others have realized its importance.
So gone at 63, but my goodness, what living she packed into those years.
Unbelievable. And so, so fundamentally important. So thanks to Irv for doing that interview. We're very touched by having had that conversation with her and happy to show it to you again. And we will see all of you next week.
We hope.
Well, like her, we're a little skeptical, but we're hanging in as long as everybody else does. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thanks for watching.